finger around his shirt button.
Then why?
Let's not get all serious, Alice, huh? No need to go on about things, is there? Can't we just have a nice time?
Alice lifted her hand from his shirt. She twisted and lowered herself down onto the rug so that only their shoulders were touching.
Sure.
They lay in the grass, side by side, looking up at the sky in silence. When he spoke again, his voice was soft.
Alice?
She glanced at him. She swallowed, her heart thumping against her ribcage. She placed her hand on his, trying to convey to him her tacit encouragement, to tell him without words that she would be a support, that it would be okay, whatever he said. She was his wife, after all. She waited a moment.
Yes?
It's a cardinal, he said. The red one. I'm pretty sure it's a cardinal.
Chapter 4. Marriage, they say, halves one's rights and doubles one's duties. Louisa May Alcott, Little Women. The first memory Marjorie O'Hare had was of sitting under her mother's kitchen table and watching through her fingers as her father slugged her 14-year-old brother Jack across the room, knocking two teeth clean out of his jaw when he tried to stop him beating her mother. Her mother, who took a fair number of beatings but would not tolerate that fate for her children, promptly threw a kitchen chair at her husband's head, leaving him with a jagged scar on his forehead that remained until he died. He hit her back with its smashed leg, of course, once he was able to stand straight, and the fight had only stopped when Papa O'Hare had staggered round from next door with his rifle at his shoulder and murder in his eyes and threatened to blow Frank O'Hare's damn head clean off his damn shoulders if he didn't stop. It wasn't that Grandpa believed his son beating his wife was inherently wrong, Marjorie discovered some time later, but Meemaw had been trying to listen to the wireless, and half the holler couldn't hear past the screaming. There was a hole in the pinewood wall that Marjorie could put her whole fist into for the rest of her childhood. Jack left for good that day, a wad of bloodied cotton in his mouth and his one good shirt in his kit bag, and the next time Marjorie heard his name, leaving was considered such an act of family disloyalty he was effectively disappeared from family history, was 8 years later when they received a wire to say that Jack had died after being hit by a railroad car in Missouri. Her mother had cried salty, heartbroken tears into her apron, but her father had hurled a book at her and told her to pull her damn self together before he really gave her something to cry about, and disappeared to his stills. The book was Black Beauty, and Marjorie never forgave him for having ripped off the back cover while doing so, and somehow her love for her lost brother and her desire to escape into the world of books became melded together into something fierce and obstinate in that one broken-backed copy.
"Don't you marry one of these fools," her mother would whisper to her and her sister as she tucked them into the big hay bed in the back room. "You make sure you two get as far from this damn mountain as you can, as soon as you can. You promise me."
The girls had nodded solemnly. Virginia had got away all right, got as far as Lewisburg, only to marry a man who turned out to be just as handy with his fists as their father had been. Her mother, thank goodness, was not alive to see it, having caught pneumonia 6 months after the wedding and died within 3 days, the same strain that took three of Marjorie's brothers. Their graves were marked with small stones on a hill overlooking the holler. When her father died, killed in a drunken gunfight with Bill McCullough, the latest sorry episode in a clan feud that had lasted generations, the residents of Baileyville noted that Marjorie O'Hare didn't shed so much as a tear. "Why would I?" she said when Pastor McIntosh asked her if she was quite all right. "I'm glad he's dead. Can't do no more harm to no one." The fact that Frank O'Hare was reviled in town and that everyone knew she was right didn't stop them deciding that the surviving O'Hare girl was as odd as the rest of them,
and that, frankly, the fewer of that bloodline still around, the better.
"Can I ask you about your family?" Alice had said as they saddled up the horses shortly after dawn. Marjorie, her thoughts still lost somewhere in Sven's strong, hard body, had had to be spoken to twice before she realized what Alice was saying.
"Ask what you want."
She glanced over.
"Let me guess. Someone tell you you shouldn't be around me because of my daddy?"
"Well, yes," said Alice after a pause. Mr. Van Cleve had given her a lecture on that exact subject the previous evening, accompanied by much spluttering and finger-pointing. Alice had wielded the good name of Mrs. Brady as a shield, but it had been an uncomfortable exchange. Marjorie nodded, as if this was no surprise. She swung her saddle onto the rail and ran her fingers over Charlie's back, checking him for bumps and sores.
"Frank O'Hare supplied moonshine to half the county. Shot up anyone who tried to take over his patch. Shot him if he reckoned they'd even thought about it. Killed more people than I know of, and left scars on everyone he was close to."
"Everyone?" Marjorie hesitated a moment, then took a couple of steps toward Alice. She rolled up her shirt sleeve, tugging it above the elbow, revealing a waxy, coin-shaped scar on her upper arm.
"Shot me with his hunting rifle when I was 11 years old because I sassed him. If my brother hadn't pushed me out of the way, he would have killed me."
Alice took a moment to speak.
"Didn't the police do anything?"
"Police."
She said it, po-lease.
"Up here, people take care of things their own way. When Meemaw found out what he'd done, she took a horsewhip to him. Only two people he was ever scared of, his own mom and pop."
Marjorie put her head down so that her thick, dark hair fell forward. She ran her fingers nimbly over her scalp until she found what she was looking for and pulled her hair to one side, revealing an inch-wide gap of bare skin.
"That was where he pulled me up two flights of stairs by my hair 3 days after Meemaw died. Pulled a handful of it clean out. They say he still had half my scalp attached to it when he dropped it."
"You don't remember?"
"Nope. He'd knocked me out before he did it."
Alice stood in stunned silence. Marjorie's voice was as level as always.
"I'm so sorry," she faltered.
"Don't be. When he died, there were two people in this whole town came to his funeral, and one of those only did because they felt sorry for me. You know how much this town loves to meet up? You imagine how much they hated him not even to show up at a man's funeral."
"You don't miss him, then?"
"Huh. Round here, Alice, you get a lot of what you call sundowners. They're good old boys in daylight hours, but come nightfall when they get to drinking, they're basically a pair of fists looking for a target."
Alice thought of Mr. Van Cleve's bourbon-fueled rants and shivered despite the heat.
"Well, my daddy wasn't even a sundowner. He didn't need drink. Cold as ice. Don't have a single good memory of him."
"Not a single one?"
Marjorie thought for a moment.
"Oh, no, you're right. There was one."
Alice waited.
"Yep. The day the sheriff stopped by to tell me he was dead."
Marjorie turned from the mule, and the two women finished up in silence. Alice felt completely out of her depth. Anyone else, she would have commiserated. Marjorie seemed to need less sympathy than anyone she'd ever met. Perhaps Marjorie detected some of these mental gymnastics, or perhaps she felt she'd been a little harsh, because she turned to Alice and smiled suddenly. Alice was struck by the fact that she was actually quite beautiful.
"You asked me a while back if I was ever frightened up there in the mountains on my own."
Alice's hand stilled on the girth buckle.
"Well, I'll tell you something. I've been afraid of nothing since the day my daddy passed. See that there?"
She pointed toward the mountains that loomed in the distance.
"That's what I dreamed of as a child. Me and Charlie, up there, that's my heaven, Alice. I get to live my heaven every day."
She let out a long breath, and as Alice was still digesting the softening of her face, the strange luminosity of her smile, she turned and slapped the back of her saddle.
"Right, you all set? Big day for you. Big day for us all." It was the first week that the four women had split up and ridden their own routes. They planned to meet at the library at the beginning and end of each week to debrief, try to keep the books in order, and check the condition of those returned. Marjorie and Beth rode the longer routes, often leaving their books at a second base, a schoolhouse 10 miles away, and bringing those back fortnightly, while Alice and Izzy did the routes closer to home. Izzy had grown in confidence now, and several times Alice had arrived as she was already riding out, her polished new boots from Lexington gleaming, her humming audible the whole way down Main Street.
"Good morning, Alice,"
she would call, her wave a little tentative, as if she were still not quite sure of the response she was going to get. Alice didn't want to admit how nervous she felt. It wasn't just her fear of getting lost or of making a fool of herself, but the conversation she had overheard between Beth and Mrs. Brady the week before as she had unsaddled Spirit outside.
"Oh, you are all just marvelous, but I confess, I am a little anxious about the English girl."
"She's doing fine, Mrs. Brady. Marge says she knows most of the routes pretty well."
"It's not the routes, Beth, dear. The whole point of using local girls to do the job was that the people you visit know you. They trust you not to look down at them or to give their families anything unsuitable to read. If we have some strange girl going in talking with an accent and acting like the Queen of England, well, they're going to be on their guard. I'm afraid it's going to damage the whole scheme."
Spirit had snorted, and they had quieted abruptly, as if realizing someone might be outside. Alice, ducking back behind the window, had felt a spasm of anxiety. If local people wouldn't take her books, she realized, they wouldn't let her have the job. She imagined herself suddenly back inside the Van Cleve house, heavy with silence, Annie's beady, suspicious gaze on her, and a decade stretching ahead of her at every hour. She thought of Bennett and the wall of his sleeping back, his refusal to try to talk about what was going on. She thought of Mr. Van Cleve's irritation that they had not yet provided him with a little grand babby. "If I lose this job," she thought, and something solid and heavy settled in her stomach, "I will have nothing."
"Good morning."
The whole way up the mountain, Alice had been practicing. She had murmured,
"Well, good morning, and how are you this fine day?"
to Spirit over and over, rolling her mouth around the vowels, trying to stop herself sounding so clipped and English. A young woman, probably not much older than Alice, emerged from a cabin and peered at her, shading her eyes. In the sunlit, grassy patch in front of the house, two children looked up at her. They resumed their desultory fight over a stick while a dog watched intently. A bowl of unshucked sweet corn had been left, as if awaiting transport, and a pile of laundry lay on a sheet on the ground. Some pulled weeds were thrown in a pile by the vegetable patch, the earth still on their roots. The house appeared surrounded by such half-finished tasks. From inside, Alice could hear a baby crying, a furious, disconsolate wail.
"Mrs. Bly?
Can I help you?"
Alice took a breath.
"Good morning. I'm from the traveling library," she said carefully. "I was wondering if you would like some books for you and the youngins, for to do some book learning."
The woman's smile faded.
"It's okay. They don't cost nothing," Alice added, smiling.
She pulled a book from her saddlebag.
"You can borrow 4, and I'll just come pick 'em up next week."
The woman was silent. She narrowed her eyes, pursed her lips, and looked down at her shoes. Then she brushed her hands on her apron and looked up again.
"Miss, are you mocking me?"
Alice's eyes widened.
"You're the English one, right? Married to Van Cleve's boy? Because if you're after mocking me, you can head straight off back down that mountain."
"I'm not mocking you," Alice said quickly.
"Then you got something wrong with your jaw?"
Alice swallowed. The woman was frowning at her. I'm so sorry, she said. I was told people wouldn't trust me enough to take books from me if I sounded too English. I was just...
Her voice trailed away.
You was trying to sound like you was from round here?
The woman's chin pulled into her neck.
I know. Said like that, it sounds rather...
Alice closed her eyes and groaned inwardly. The woman snorted with laughter. Alice's eyes snapped open. The woman started to laugh again, bent over her apron.
You tried to sound like you was from round here. Garrett, you hear that?
I heard,
came a man's voice, followed by a burst of coughing. Mrs. Bly clutched her sides and laughed until she had to wipe the corners of her eyes. The children, watching her, began to chuckle too, with the hopeful, bemused faces of those who weren't quite sure what they were laughing at.
Oh, my. Oh, miss, I ain't laughed like that since as long as I can remember. You come on in now. I'd take books off you if you was from the other side of the world. I'm Kathleen. Come on in. You need some water? It's hot enough to fry a snake out here.
Alice tied Spirit to the nearest tree and pulled a selection of books out of her pack. She followed the young woman up to the cabin, noting that there was no glass in the windows, just wooden shutters, and wondered absently what it must be like in the winter. She waited in the doorway as her eyes acclimatized to the darkness, and gradually the interior revealed itself. The cabin appeared to be divided into two rooms. The walls of the front one were lined with newspaper, and on the far side stood a large wood-burning stove, beside which stood a stack of logs. Above the fireplace hung a string of tied candles and a large hunting rifle on the wall. A table and four chairs stood in the corner, and a baby lay in a large crate beside it. Its little fists pummeled the air as it cried. The woman stooped and picked it up with a vague air of exhaustion, and the crying stopped. It was then that Alice noticed the man in the bed across the room. The quilted covers pulled up to his chest. He was young and handsome, but his skin had the waxy pallor of the chronically ill. The air was still and stale around him, despite the open windows, and every 30 seconds or so, he coughed. Good morning, she said, when she saw he was looking at her.
Morning,
he said, his voice weak and raspy.
Garrett Bly. Sorry I can't stand just now to...
She shook her head, as if it was of no matter.
Have you got any of those Woman's Home Companion magazines? Said the young woman. This baby is just a devil to settle right now, and I was wondering if they had anything would help. I can read good enough, can't I, Garrett? Miss O'Hare brought me some a while back, and they had advice on all sorts. I think it's his teeth, but he don't want to chew on nothing.
Alice, startled, pulled back into action. She began flicking through the books and magazines, eventually pulling out two that she handed over.
Would the children like something?
You got any of those picture books? Polly's got his alphabet, but his sister just looks at the pictures. She loves them, though.
Of course.
Alice found two primers and handed them over. Kathleen smiled, placing them reverently on the table, and handed Alice a cup of water.
I got some recipes. Got one for honey apple cake handed down from my mama. If you want it, I'd be happy to write it out and give it to you.
Mountain people, Marjorie had instructed her, were proud. Many of them didn't feel comfortable receiving without giving something back.
I'd love that. Thank you so much.
Alice drank the water and handed back her cup. She made to leave, muttering about time getting on, when she realized that Kathleen and her husband were exchanging a look. She stood, wondering if she had missed something. They looked back at her, and the woman smiled brightly. Neither said a word. Alice waited a moment until it became awkward.
Well, it's lovely to meet you all. I'll see you in a week, and I'll make sure to look out for more articles about teething babies. Anything you want, I'll be happy to search it out. We have new books and magazines coming in by the week.
She gathered up the remaining books.
I'll see you next time, then.
Much obliged to you.
Came the whispering voice from the bed,
and then the words were lost in another bout of coughing. The outside seemed impossibly bright after the gloom of the cabin. Alice found herself squinting as she waved goodbye to the children and made her way back across the grass to Spirit. She hadn't realized how high up they were here. She could see halfway across the county. She stopped for a minute, reveling in the view.
Miss?
She turned. Kathleen Bly was running toward her. She stopped a few feet from Alice, then compressed her lips briefly, as if she were afraid to speak.
Is there something else?
Miss, my husband, he loves to read, but his eyes ain't too good in the dark, and to be honest, he struggles to focus because of the black lung. He's in some pain most days. Could you read to him a little?
Read to him?
It takes his mind away. I can't do it because I got the house to mind and the baby and kindling to chop. I wouldn't ask, but Marjorie did it the other week, and if you could spare a half hour just to read him a chapter or something, well, it would mean the world to both of us.
Kathleen's face, away from her husband, had collapsed into exhaustion and strain, as if she dared not show what she felt in front of him. Her eyes glittered. She lifted her chin abruptly, as if she were embarrassed to be asking for anything.
Of course, if you're too busy.
Alice reached out and put a hand on her arm.
Why don't you tell me a little of what he likes? I have a new book of short stories here that sounds like it might be just the ticket. What do you think?
40 minutes later, Alice picked her way down the mountain. Garrett Bly had closed his eyes while she read, and sure enough, 20 minutes into the story, a stirring tale of a sailor shipwrecked on high seas, she had glanced from her stool beside the bed and observed that the muscles of his face, which had been taut with discomfort, had indeed relaxed, as if he had taken himself somewhere else entirely. She kept her voice low, murmuring, and even the baby seemed to settle at the sound. Outside, Kathleen was a pale blur, chopping kindling, fetching, picking and carrying, alternately calming arguments and scolding. By the time the story finished, Garrett was asleep, his breath rasping in his chest.
Thank you, Kathleen said as Alice loaded her saddlebags.
She held out 2 large apples and a piece of paper on which she had carefully written a recipe.
That's what I was telling you about. These apples are good for bacon because they don't go all to a mush. Just don't overcook them.
Her face had brightened again, her former resolve apparently restored.
That's very kind of you. Thank you, said Alice, and tucked them carefully into her pockets.
Kathleen nodded, as if a debt had been repaid, and Alice mounted her horse. She thanked her again and set off.
Mrs. Van Cleve?
Kathleen called when Alice had gone some 20 yards down the track. Alice turned in her saddle.
Yes?
Kathleen folded her arms across her chest and lifted her chin.
I think your voice sounds real fine, just like it is.
The sun was fierce, and the no-see-ums, the biting midges, were relentless. Through the long afternoon, Alice, slapping at her neck and cursing, was grateful for the canvas-brimmed hat Marjorie had lent her. She managed to press an embroidery primer onto twin sisters who lived down by the creek, and seemed to view even that with suspicion, was chased from a large house by a mean-looking dog, and gave a Bible reader to a family of 11 in the smallest house she had ever seen, where a series of hay mattresses lay on the porch.
Children of mine read nothing but the good book, the mother had said from behind a half-closed door, and set her jaw, as if braced for contradiction.
Then I'll look out for some more Bible stories for you next week, Alice said, and tried to make her smile brighter than it felt as the door closed.
After the small victory at the Bly house, she had begun to feel dispirited. She wasn't sure if it was the books people were viewing with suspicion or her. She kept hearing Mrs. Brady's voice, her reservations about whether Alice could do the job given her foreignness. She was so distracted by this that it was some time before she realized she had stopped registering Marjorie's red threads on the trees and was now lost. She stopped in a clearing,
trying to gauge from her hand-drawn maps where she was meant to be, struggling to see the position of the sun through the dark green canopy above. Spirit stood stock still, her head drooping in the mid-afternoon heat that managed to penetrate the branches.
"Aren't you meant to be finding your way home?" said Alice grumpily.
She was forced to conclude she had no clue where she was. She would have to retrace her steps until she found her way back to a landmark. She turned the horse and wearily made her way up the side of the mountain. It was a full half hour before she recognized anything. She had tamped down her rising sense of panic at the creeping realization that she could quite easily end up on the mountainside at night, in the dark, with snakes and mountain lions and goodness knew what all around, or, just as worrying, at one of the addresses she was on no account to make a stop at. Beaver, on Frog Creek, crazy like a fox, the McCullough House, Moonshiners, mostly drunk, not sure about the girls as no one ever sees them, the Garside brothers, drunk, ornery with it. She wasn't sure whether she was more afraid of the prospect of being shot for trespass or of Mrs. Brady's response when it emerged that the English woman had not, after all, known what on earth she was doing. Around her, the landscape seemed to have stretched, revealing its vastness and her own ignorance at her place within it. Why hadn't she paid more attention to Marjorie's instructions? She squinted at the shadows, trying to work out where she might be according to their direction, then cursed when the clouds or the movement of the branches made them vanish. She was so relieved when she spied the red knot on the tree trunk that it took her a moment to grasp the identity of the house she was now approaching. Alice rode past the front gate with her eyes lowered and her head down. The weather-boarded house was silent. The iron kettle sat outside in a cold pile of ash, and a large axe lay abandoned in a chunk of tree stump. Two dirty glass windows eyed her blankly. And there they were, four books in a neat pile by the post, just where Marjorie had told Jim Horner to leave them if he decided he didn't want books in his house after all. She pulled Spirit up and climbed off, one eye warily on the window, remembering the bullet-sized hole in Marjorie's hat. The books appeared untouched. She picked them up under one arm, packed them carefully in her saddlebags, then checked the mare's girth. She had one foot in the stirrup, her heart beating uncomfortably fast, when she heard the man's voice echo out across the holler.
"Hey!"
She stopped.
"Hey, you!"
Alice closed her eyes.
"You that library girl stopped here before?"
"I wasn't bothering you, Mr. Horner," she called. I just came to pick up the books. I'll be gone before you know it. Nobody else will come by."
"You was lying?"
"What?"
Alice took her foot out of the stirrup and spun around.
"You said you was going to bring us some more."
Alice blinked. He wasn't smiling, but he wasn't holding a gun either. He stood in the doorway, his hands loosely by his sides, and lifted one to point at the gatepost.
"You want more books?"
"Said so, didn't I?"
"Oh, goodness, of course,
Nerves made her clumsy. She fumbled in the bag, pulling and rejecting what came to hand.
"Yes, well, I brought some Mark Twain and a book of recipes. Oh, and this magazine has some canning tips. You were all canning, weren't you? I can leave that if you like."
"I want a speller."
He pointed loosely, as if that might summon it.
"For the girls. I want one of them with just words and a picture each page. Nothing fancy."
"I think I have something like that. Hold on."
Alice rummaged in her saddlebag and eventually pulled out a child's reading book.
"Like this? This one has been very popular among..."
"Just leave them by the post."
"Done. There they are. Lovely."
Alice stooped to place the books in a neat pile, then backed away and turned to spring onto her horse.
"Right, I'm going now. Be sure to let me know if there's anything particular you want me to bring next week."
She lifted a hand. Jim Horner was standing in the doorway, two girls behind him, watching her. Although her heart was still beating wildly, when she reached the bottom of the dirt track, she found she was smiling. Chapter 5. Each mine, or group of mines, became a social center with no privately owned property except the mine, and no public places or public highway except the bed of the creek, which flowed between the mountain walls. These groups of villages dot the mountainsides down the river valleys and need only castles, drawbridges, and donjon keeps to reproduce to the physical eye a view of feudal days. United States Coal Commission, in 1923. It pained Marjorie to admit it, but the little library on Split Creek Road was growing chaotic, and faced with the ever-growing demand for books, not one of the four of them had time to do much about it. Despite the initial suspicion of some inhabitants of Lee County, word had spread about the book ladies, as they had become known, and within a few short weeks it was more common for them to be greeted by eager smiles than it was for doors to be rapidly closed in their faces. Families clamored for reading material, from the Woman's Home Companion to the Furrow for Men. Everything from Charles Dickens to the Dime Mystery Magazine was ripped from their hands almost as soon as they could pull it from their saddlebags. The comic books, wildly popular among the county's children, suffered most, being thumbed to death or their fragile pages ripped as siblings fought over them. Magazines would occasionally be returned with a favorite page quietly removed. And still the demand came. "Miss, have you got new books for us?" When the librarians returned to their base at Frederick Geisler's cabin, instead of plucking rigorously organized books from his handmade shelves, they were more often to be found on the floor, riffling through countless piles for the requested titles, yelling at each other when someone else turned out to be sitting on the one they needed.
"I guess we're victims of our own success," said Marjorie, glancing around at the stacks on the floor. "Should we start sorting through them?"
Beth was smoking a cigarette. Her father would have whipped her if he'd seen it, and Marjorie pretended she hadn't.
"No point. We'll barely touch the sides this morning, and it'll be just as bad when we get back. No, I've been thinking we need someone here full-time to sort it out."
Beth looked at Izzy.
"You wanted to stay back here, didn't you? And she ain't the strongest of writers."
Izzy bristled.
"I do not, thank you, Beth. My families know me. They wouldn't like it if someone else took over my roots."
She had a point. Despite Beth's sly digs, Izzy Brady, in 6 short weeks, had grown into a competent horsewoman, if not a great one, her balance compensating for her weaker leg, its difference now invisible in the dark mahogany leather boots that she kept polished to a high shine. She had taken to carrying her stick on the back of the saddle to aid her when she had to walk the last steps up to a house, and found it came in handy for whacking at branches, keeping mean dogs at bay, and shifting the occasional snake. Most families around Baileyville were a little in awe of Mrs. Brady, and Izzy, once she'd introduced herself, was usually welcomed.
"Besides, Beth,"
Izzy added, slyly producing her trump card,
"you know if I stay here, you'll have my mother fixin' and fussin' all the time. Only thing keeping her away now is thinking I'm out all day."
"Oh, I'd really rather not," said Alice as Marjorie turned toward her. "My family's are doing well, too. Jim Horner's eldest girl read the whole of The American Girl last week. He was so proud he even forgot to shout at me."
"I guess it's Beth, then," said Izzy.
Beth stubbed out her cigarette on the wood floor with the heel of her boot.
"Don't look at me. I hate cleaning up. Do enough of it for my damn brothers."
"Do you have to curse?"
Izzy sniffed.
"It's not just clearing up,"
Marjorie said, picking up a copy of the Pickwick Papers, from which the innards sagged in a weary spray.
"These were ratty to start with, and now they're falling apart. We need someone who can sew up the binders and maybe make scrapbooks out of all these loose pages. They're doing that over at Hinman, and they're real popular. Got recipes and stories in them and everything."
"My sewing is atrocious," said Alice quickly. and the others concurred loudly that they, too, were awful at it. Marjorie pulled an exasperated face.
Well, I ain't doing it. Got paws for hands.
She thought for a minute.
I got an idea, though.
She got up from behind the table and reached for her hat.
What? Said Alice.
Where are you going? Said Beth.
Hoffman. Beth, can you pick up some of my rounds? I'll see y'all later.
You could hear the ominous sounds of the Hoffman Mining Company a good couple of miles before you saw it. The rumble of the coal trucks, the distant whoomph of the explosions that vibrated through your feet, the clang of the mine bell. For Marjorie, Hoffman was a vision of hell, its pits eating into the scarred and hollowed-out hillsides around Baileyville like giant welts, its men, their eyes glowing white out of blackened faces, emerging from its bowels, and the low industrial hum of nature being stripped and ravaged. Around the settlement, the taste of coal dust hung in the air, with an ever-present sense of foreboding, explosions covering the valley with a gray filter. Even Charlie balked at it. A certain kind of man looked at God's own land, she thought, as she drew closer, and instead of beauty and wonder, all he saw was dollar signs. Hoffman was a town with its own rules. The price of a wage and a roof over your head was a creeping debt to the company store, and the never-ending fear of a misjudged measurement of dynamite, a lost limb from a runaway trolley, or worse, the end of it all, several hundred feet below, with little chance for your loved ones to recover a body to grieve over. And, since a year back, all of this had become suffused in an air of mistrust as the Union Busters arrived to beat back those who had the temerity to campaign for better conditions. The mine bosses didn't like change, and they had shown it not in argument and raised fists, but with mobs, guns, and now, families in mourning.
That you, Marjorie O'Hare?
The guard took two steps toward her as she rode up, his hand shielding his eyes from the sun.
Sure is, Bob. You know Gustafson's here? Everything all right?
She felt the familiar metallic taste in her mouth whenever she heard Sven's name.
Everyone accounted for. Think they're just having a bite to eat before they head off. Last saw him over by B Block.
She dismounted and tied up the mule, then walked through the gates, ignoring the glances from miners clocking off. She walked briskly past the commissary, its windows advertising various on-sale bargains that everyone knew to be no bargain at all. It stood on the hillside at the same level as the huge tipple. Above it were the generous, well-maintained houses of the mine bosses and their foremen, most with neat backyards. This was where Van Cleve would have lived, had Dolores not refused to leave her family home back in Baileyville. It was not one of the larger coal camps, like Lynch, where some 10,000 homes scattered the hillsides. Here, a couple of hundred miners' shacks stretched along the tracks, their roofs covered with tar paper, barely updated in the 40-odd years of their existence. A few children, mostly shoeless, played in the dirt beside a rootling pig. Car parts and washing pails were strewn outside front doors, and stray dogs trotted haphazard paths between them. Marjorie turned right, away from the residential roads, and walked briskly over the small bridge that led to the mines. She spied his back first. He was sitting on an upturned crate, his helmet cradled between his feet as he ate a hunk of bread. She'd know him anywhere, she thought. The way his neck met his shoulders and his head tilted a little to the left when he spoke. His shirt was covered with smuts, and the tabard that read fire on his back was slightly askew.
Hey?
He turned at the sound of her voice, stood, and lifted his hands as his workmates began a series of low whistles, as if he were trying to tamp down a fire.
Marge, what are you doing here?
He took her arm, steering her away from the catcalls as they walked around the corner. She looked at Sven's blackened palms.
Everyone okay?
His eyebrows lifted.
This time.
He shot a look at the administrative offices that told her everything she needed to know. She reached up and wiped a smudge from his face with her thumb. He stopped her and pressed her hand to his lips. It always made something flip inside her, even if she didn't let it show on her face.
You missed me then?
No.
Liar.
They grinned at each other.
I came to find William Kenworth. I need to speak to his sister.
Colored William? He isn't here no more, Marge. He got injured out, oh, 6, 9 months back.
She looked startled.
I thought I told you. Some powder monkey messed up his wires and he was in the way when they blasted that tunnel through Feller's top. Boulder took his leg clean off.
So where is he now?
No idea. I can find out, though.
She waited outside the administrative offices while Sven went in and sweet-talked Mrs. Pfeiffer, whose favorite word was no, but she rarely used it on Sven. Everyone across the 5 coal patches of Lee County loved Sven. He had, along with solid shoulders and fists the size of hams, an air of quiet authority, a twinkle in his eye, which told men he was one of them and women he liked them. Not just in that way. He was good at his job, kind when he felt he needed to be, and he spoke to everyone with the same uncommon civility, whether it was a ragged, trousered kid from the next holler or the big bosses at the mine. Most days, she could reel off a whole list of the things she liked about Sven Gustafsson. Not that she'd tell him. He came down the steps from the office holding a piece of paper.
He's over at Monarch Creek at his late mother's place. Been pretty poorly by all accounts. Turns out they'd only treat him the first couple of months in the hospital here, then he was out. Good of them.
Sven knew well how little she regarded Hoffman.
What do you want him for, anyway?
I wanted to find his sister, but if he's sick, I don't know if I should be bothering him. Last I heard, she was working in Louisville.
Oh, no. Mrs. Pfeiffer just told me his sister's the one looking out for him. Chances are you head over there, you'll find her too.
She took the piece of paper from him and looked up. His eyes were on her, and his face softened under the black.
So when will I see you?
Depends on when you stop yammering on about getting married.
He glanced behind him, then pulled her around the corner, placing her back against the wall as he stood close as he could get.
Okay, how's this? Marjorie O'Hare, I solemnly promise never to marry you.
And?
And I won't talk about marrying you, or sing songs about it, or even think about marrying you.
Better?
He glanced around him, then lowered his voice, placing his mouth beside her ear so that she squirmed a little.
But I will stop by and do sinful things to that fine body of yours. If you'll allow me.
How sinful?
She whispered.
Oh, bad. Ungodly.
She slid her hand inside his overalls, feeling the faint sheen of sweat on his warm skin. For a moment, it was just the two of them. The sounds and scents of the mine receded, and all she could feel was the thumping of her heart, the pulse of his skin against hers, the ever-present drumbeat of her need for him.
God loves a sinner, Sven.
She reached up and kissed him, then delivered a swift bite to his lower lip.
But not as much as I do.
He burst out laughing, and to her surprise, as she walked back to the mule, the safety crew's catcalls still ringing out, her cheeks had gone quite, quite pink. It had been a long day. And by the time she reached the little cabin at Monarch Creek, both she and the mule were weary. She dismounted and threw her reins over the post.
Hello?
Nobody emerged. A carefully tended vegetable patch lay to the left of the cabin, and a small lean-to skimmed it, with 2 baskets hanging from the porch. Unlike most of the houses around this holler, it was freshly painted, the grass trimmed, and weeds beaten into submission. A red rocker sat by the door, looking out across the water meadow.
Hello?
A woman's face appeared at the screen door. She glanced out as if checking something, then turned away, speaking to someone inside.
"That you, Miss Marjorie?"
"Hey, Miss Sophia, how you doing?"
The screen door opened, and the woman stood back to let Marjorie in, her hands on her hips, thick, dark coils of hair pinned to her scalp. She lifted her head, as if surveying her carefully.
"Well, now, I haven't seen you in, what, 8 years?"
"Something like that. You haven't changed none, though."
"Get in here."
Her face, so thin and stern in repose, broke into a lovely smile, and Marjorie repaid it in full. For several years, Marjorie had accompanied her father on his moonshine runs to Hoffman, one of his more lucrative routes. Frank O'Hare figured that nobody would look twice at a girl with her daddy making deliveries into the settlement, and he figured right. But while he made his way around the residential section, trading jars and paying off security guards, she would make her way quietly to the colored block, where Miss Sophia would lend her books from her family's small collection. Marjorie had not been allowed to go to school. Frank had seen to that. He didn't believe in book learning, no matter how hard her mother had pleaded. But Miss Sophia and her mother, Miss Ada, had fostered in her a love of reading that many evenings had taken her a million miles from the darkness and violence of her home. And it wasn't just the books. Miss Sophia and Miss Ada always looked immaculate, their nails perfectly filed, their hair rolled and braided with surgical precision. Miss Sophia was only a year older than Marjorie, but her family represented to her a kind of order, a suggestion that life could be conducted quite differently from the noise, chaos, and fear of her own.
"You know, I used to think you were going to eat those books, you were so hungry for them. Never knew a girl read so many so fast."
They smiled at each other. And then Marjorie spied William. He was seated in a chair by the window, and the left leg of his pants was pinned neatly under the stump where it ended. She tried not to let the shock of it show as even a flicker on her face.
"Good afternoon, Miss Marjorie."
"I'm real sorry to hear about your accident, William. Are you in much pain?"
"It's tolerable," he said. "Just don't like not being able to work, that's all."
"He's about as ornery as all get out," said Sophia, and rolled her eyes. "He hates being in the house more than he hates losing that leg. You sit down and I'll fetch you a drink."
"She tells me I make the place look untidy."
William shrugged. The Kenworth cabin was the neatest, Marjorie suspected, for 20 miles. There was not a speck of dust or an item out of place, testament to Sophia's fearsome organizational skills. Marjorie sat and drank a glass of sarsaparilla and listened as William told her how the mine had laid him off after his accident.
"Union tried to stand up for me, but since the shootings, well, nobody wants to stick their neck out too far for a black fellow. You know what I'm saying?"
"They shot two more Union men last month."
"I heard."
William shook his head.
"The Stiller brothers shot the tires out of 3 trucks headed out from the tipple. Next time they went into the company store at Friars to organize some of the men, a bunch of thugs trapped them in there and a whole bunch had to come over from Hoffman's to get them out. He's sending a warning."
"Who?"
"Van Cleve. You know he's behind half of this."
"Everybody knows," said Sophia. "Everybody knows what goes on in that place, but nobody wants to do nothing."
The three of them sat in silence for so long that Marjorie almost forgot why she had come. Finally, she put her glass down.
"This isn't just a social call," she said.
"You don't say," said Sophia.
"I don't know if you heard, but I've been setting up a library over at Baileyville. We got 4 of us librarians, just local girls, and a whole lot of donated books and journals, some on their last legs. Well, we need someone to organize us and fix up the books because it turns out you can't do 15 hours a day in the saddle and keep the rest of it straight, too."
Sophia and William looked at each other.
"I'm not sure what this has to do with us," Sophia said.
"Well,
I was wondering if you'd come and organize it for us. We have a budget for 5 librarians, and there's a decent wage, paid for by the WPA, and the money's good for at least a year.
Sophia leaned back in her seat. Marjorie persisted.
I know you loved working at the library at Louisville, and you could be back here in an hour each day. We'd be glad to have you.
It's a colored library.
Sophia's voice hardened. She folded her hands in her lap.
The library at Louisville, it's for colored folk. You must be aware of that, Miss Marjorie. I can't come work for a white person's library unless you're actually asking me to ride horses with you, and I can sure as anything tell you I'm not going to be doing that.
It's a traveling library. People don't come in and out borrowing stuff. We go to them.
So?
So nobody even needs to know you're there. Look, Miss Sophia, we're desperate for your help. I need someone I can trust to mend the books and get us straight, and you are, by anyone's standards, the finest librarian for 3 counties.
I'm going to say it again. It's a white person's library.
Things are changing.
You tell the men in hoods that when they come knocking at our door.
So what are you doing here?
I'm looking after my brother.
I know that. I'm asking what you're doing for money.
The 2 siblings exchanged a look.
That's a mighty personal question, even for you.
William sighed.
We ain't doing too good. We're living off what we got saved and what our mama left, but it ain't much.
William, Sophia scolded him.
Well, it's the truth. We know Miss Marjorie. She knows us.
So you want me to go get my head busted working in a white folks library?
I won't let that happen,
said Marjorie, calmly. It was the first time Sophia did not answer. There were few advantages to being the offspring of Frank O'Hare, but people who had known him understood that if Marjorie promised something would happen, then in all likelihood it would. If you had survived a childhood with Frank O'Hare, not much else was going to stand in your way.
Oh, and it's $28 a month, said Marjorie. Same wage as the rest of us.
Sophia looked at her brother, then down at her lap. Finally, she lifted her head.
We'll have to think about it.
Okay.
Sophia pursed her lips.
You still as messy as you was?
Probably a little worse.
Sophia stood and straightened her skirt.
Like I said, we'll think about it.
William saw her out. He insisted, raising himself laboriously from his chair, while Sophia handed him his crutch. He winced with the effort of shuffling to the door, and Marjorie tried not to let on that she saw it. They stood at the door and looked out at the relative peace of the creek.
You know they're fixing to take a chunk out of the north side of the ridge.
What?
Big Cole told me. They're going to blow 6 holes straight through it. They reckon there's rich seams in there.
But that part of the mountain is occupied. There's 14-15 families just down by the north side alone.
We know that and they know that. But you think that's going to stop them once they sniff paper money?
But what'll happen to the families?
Same thing that happens every time.
He rubbed his forehead.
Kentucky, huh? Most beautiful place on earth and the most brutal. Sometimes I think God wanted to show us all his ways at once.
William leaned against the doorframe, adjusting his wooden crotch under his armpit while Marjorie digested this.
It's good to see you, Miss Marjorie. You take care now.
You too, William. And tell your sister to come work at our library.
He raised an eyebrow.
Huh. She's like you. No man going to tell her what to do.
She could hear him chuckling as he closed the screen door behind him. Chapter 6. My mother didn't hold with 24-hour-old pies, except mince. She would get up an hour earlier in order to bake a pie before breakfast, but she would not bake any kind of custard or fruit pie, even pumpkin, the day before it was to be used, and if she had, my father wouldn't have eaten it.
Della T. Lutz, Farm Journal. In the first months after she had moved to Baileyville, Alice had almost enjoyed the weekly church dinners. Having a fourth or fifth person at the table seemed to lift the atmosphere in the somber house, and the food was mostly a cut above Annie's usual greasy fare. Mr. Van Cleve tended to be on his best behavior, and Pastor McIntosh, their most frequent visitor, was essentially a kind man, if a little repetitive. The most enjoyable element of Kentucky society, she observed, was the endless stories, the misfortunes of families, gossip about neighbors, every anecdote served up beautifully formed and with a punchline that would leave the table rocking with laughter. If there was more than one raconteur at the table, it would swiftly become a competitive sport. But more importantly, those animated tall tales left Alice to eat her food largely unobserved and unbothered. Or at least, they had.
"So when are you two youngins going to bless my old friend here with a grandchild or two then, huh?"
"That's what I keep asking them."
Mr. Van Cleve pointed his knife at Bennett and then Alice.
"A house isn't a home without a babby running through it."
"Maybe when our bedroom isn't so close to yours that I can hear you break wind," Alice responded silently, scooping mashed potato onto her plate. "Maybe when I'm free to walk to the bathroom without covering myself to the ankles. Maybe when I don't have to listen to this conversation at least twice a week." Pastor McIntosh's sister, Pamela, visiting from Knoxville, observed, as someone invariably did, that her son had gotten his new wife with child on the very day of their wedding.
9 months to the day the twins came. Can you believe that? Mind you, she has that house running like clockwork. You watch, she'll wean those two, and the day after, she'll be carrying again. Aren't you one of those pack horse librarians, Alice?
Pamela's husband eyed the world suspiciously from under two bushy brows. I am indeed.
The girl's gone from the house all day, Mr. Van Cleve exclaimed. Some evenings she gets back so tired she can barely keep her eyes open.
Strapping lad like you, Bennett, young Alice there should be too tired to get on a horse in the first place.
She should be bow-legged like a cowboy, though.
The two men roared with laughter. Alice forced a wan smile. She glanced at Bennett, who was steering black beans around his plate with intent focus. Then she looked at Annie, who was holding the sweet potato dish and gazing at her with something that looked uncomfortably like satisfaction. Alice hardened her look until the other woman turned away.
You got monthly stains on your breeches,
Annie had observed as she brought Alice a pile of folded laundry the previous evening.
I couldn't get it all out, so there's still a small mark.
She had paused and added,
just like last month.
Alice had bristled at the idea of the woman monitoring her monthlies. She had the sudden sensation of half the town discussing her apparent failure to fall pregnant. It couldn't be Bennett's fault, of course, not their baseball champ, not their golden boy.
You know, my cousin, the one over at Berea, she couldn't fall pregnant for love nor money. I swear her husband was at her like a dog. She went to one of the snake-handling churches. Pastor, I know you disapprove, but hear me out. They put a green garter around her neck, and she was with child the very next week. My cousin said the baby has eyes as gold as a copperhead's, but then she always was the imaginative type.
My Aunt Lola was the same. Her pastor had the whole congregation praying for God to fill her womb. Took them a year, but they got 5 children now.
Please don't feel obliged to do the same, said Alice.
I think it's all this riding the girl is doing. It's no good for a woman to sit astride all day. Dr. Freeman says it jiggles up a lady's insides.
Well, yes, I do believe I've read as much.
Mr. Van Cleve picked up his salt shaker and waggled it between his fingers.
It's like if you shake a jar of milk up too much, it turns sour. Curdles, if you like.
My insides are not curdled, thank you, Alice said stiffly, then added, after a moment, but I would be very interested to see the article.
Article? Said Pastor McIntosh.
That you mentioned, where it says a woman shouldn't ride a horse, for fear of jiggling. It's not a medical term I'm familiar with. The two men looked at each other. Alice dragged her knife across a piece of chicken, not looking up from her plate.
Knowledge is so important, don't you think? We all say at the library, without facts, we really do have nothing. If I'm putting my health at risk by riding a horse, then I think it would be only responsible for me to read the article you're talking about. Perhaps you could bring it with you next Sunday, Pastor.
She looked up and smiled brightly across the table.
Well, said Pastor McIntosh, I'm not sure I could lay my hands on it just like that.
The pastor has a lot of papers, said Mr. Van Cleve.
The funny thing is, Alice continued, waving a fork for emphasis, in England, nearly all well-brought-up ladies ride. They go out hunting, jumping ditches, fences, all sorts. It's almost compulsory. And yet they pop out babies with extraordinary efficiency. Even the royal family, pop, 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 like shelling peas. Do you know how many children Queen Victoria had? And she was always on a horse. They couldn't pull her off. The table had grown quiet.
Well, said Pastor McIntosh, that is most interesting.
It can't be good for you, though, dear, said the pastor's sister kindly. I mean, strenuous physical activity is not good for young women at the best of times.
Goodness, you'd better tell some of the mountain girls I see every day. Those women are chopping firewood, hoeing vegetable patches, cleaning house for men who are too sick or too lazy to get out of bed, and strangely, they too seem to have all those babies, one after another.
Alice,
said Bennett quietly. I can't imagine too many of them are just floating around, flower arranging and putting their feet up. Or perhaps they have a different biological makeup. That must be it. Perhaps there's a medical reason I haven't heard of for that, too.
Alice, said Bennett again.
There is nothing wrong with me, she whispered angrily. She was furious to hear the tremor in her voice. It was what they had needed. The two older men exchanged kindly looks.
Oh, don't get yourself worked up now. We're not criticizing you, Alice dear, said Mr. Van Cleve, reaching across the table and placing his plump hand over hers.
We understand it can be a disappointment when the Lord doesn't bless you straight off, but it's best not to get too emotional about it, said the pastor. I'll say a little prayer for you both when you're next in church.
That's most kind of you, said Mr. Van Cleve. Sometimes a young lady doesn't always know what's in her own interests. That's what we're here for, Alice, to mind your best interests. Now, Annie, where's that sweet potato? My gravy's getting cold here.
What did you have to do that for?
Bennett sat beside her on the swing seat as the older men repaired to the parlor, finishing off a bottle of Mr. Van Cleve's best bourbon. Their voices rose and fell, punctuated by bursts of laughter. Alice sat with her arms crossed. The evenings were growing cooler, but she positioned herself at the far end of the swing seat, a good 9 inches from the warmth of Bennett's body, a shawl around her shoulders.
Do what?
You know very well what. Pa was just trying to look out for you.
Bennett. You know that riding horses has nothing to do with why I'm not getting pregnant. He said nothing. I love my job. I truly love my job. I will not give it up because your father is under the impression that my insides are jiggling. Does anyone say you play too much baseball? No, of course they don't. But your bits are jiggling all over the place 3 times a week.
Keep your voice down.
Oh, I forgot.
We can't say anything out loud, can we? Not about your jiggling bits. We can't talk about what's really going on. But I'm the one everyone's talking about. I'm the one they think is barren.
Why do you mind what people think? You act like you don't care for half the people around here anyway.
I mind because your family and your neighbors are harping on about it all the time. And they're going to keep on unless you explain what's going on. Or just do something about it.
She had gone too far. Bennett rose abruptly from the swing seat and strode off, slamming the screen door behind him. There was a sudden silence in the parlor. As the male voices slowly picked up again, Alice sat on the swing seat, listening to the crickets and wondering how she could be in a house full of people and also in the loneliest place on earth. It had not been a good week at the library. The mountains turned from lush green to a fiery orange, the leaves forming a coppery carpet on the ground that muffled the horses' hoofs, the hollers filling with thick morning mists, and Marjorie observed that half her librarians were out of sorts. She watched Alice's uncharacteristically set jaw and shadowed eyes, and might perhaps have made an effort to sway her out of her mood, but she herself was antsy, still not having heard back from Sophia. Every evening she attempted to repair the more damaged books among their haul, but that pile had grown to a teetering height, and the thought of all the work, or all those wasted books, dismayed her even more. There was no time for her to do anything but get back on the mule and take another load out. The appetite for books had become relentless. Children followed them down the street, begging for something to read. Families they saw fortnightly would beg for the same weekly allowance as those on the shorter routes, and the librarians would have to explain that there were only four of them, and they were out all the hours of the day as it was. The horses were periodically lame from the long hours up hard, flinty tracks.
If I have to take Billy sideways up Fern Gully again, I swear he's going to end up with two legs longer than the others.
And Patch developed girth sores so that he was off work for days. It was never enough, and the strain was starting to show. As they returned on Friday evening, mud and fallen leaves treading in on their boots to add to the mess, Izzy snapped at Alice after she had tripped on Izzy's saddlebag and broken the strap.
Mind yourself!
Alice stooped to pick it up as Beth peered at it.
Well, you shouldn't have left it on the floor, should you?
It was only there a minute. I was trying to put my books down, and I needed my stick. What am I supposed to do now?
I don't know. Get your ma to buy you another?
Izzy reeled as if she had been slapped and glared at Beth.
You take that back.
Take what back? It's the damn truth.
Izzy, I'm sorry, said Alice after a moment. It really was an accident. Look, I'll see if I can find someone to fix it over the weekend.
You didn't need to be mean, Beth Pinker.
Shoot, your skin's thinner than a dragonfly's wing.
Can you two stop bickering and enter your books? I'd like to be out of here by midnight.
I can't enter mine because you haven't done yours, and if I bring my books over, we're just going to get those mixed up with the ones by your feet.
The books by my feet, Izzy Brady, are the ones you left yesterday because you couldn't be bothered to shelve them.
I told you Mother had to pick me up early so she could get to her quilting circle.
Oh, well, we can't get in the way of a damn quilting circle, can we?
Their voices had reached a pitch. Beth eyed Izzy from the corner of the room where she had just emptied her own saddlebags, along with a lunch pail and an empty lemonade bottle.
Ah, shucks. You know what we need?
What?
Said Izzy suspiciously.
We need to let our hair down a little. We're all work and no play.
She grinned.
I think we need to have us a meeting.
We're having a meeting, said Marjorie.
Not this kind of meeting,